thanks for tuning in to On the Same Page, a new podcast from the Jefferson Madison Regional Library to keep you in the loop and on the same page about what's happening at your library. Hello, and welcome back to another episode of On the Same Page. I'm your host, Abby. Erica's not with me today, but don't worry, you will still be hearing from her. We've got a couple of things to share with you in this episode. We are going to have a brief chat with Gail, the manager of the Gordon Avenue Branch Library. She's going to tell us about some upcoming renovations, which will cause the library to be closed for a little while, but very exciting renovations, so it should be beautiful when they reopen. And then we also have a recording from a program that took place at our Northside Library during February. The library was screening the movie 42, which is the Jackie Robinson story, and before the screening of the movie, they invited a local resident, Dr. Addison Hobbs, who played baseball in the minor leagues in the 40s and 50s, and he spent some time before the film talking about his experiences growing up as a Black man playing in segregated baseball, as well as his experiences going through school and working up to his career as an educator. So we are very glad that we have the opportunity to share his story with you. Felt very privileged to be able to hear it from him himself. So hope that you will enjoy that. And we're gonna hear from him after we hear from Gail. But before both of those, we will start, as always, with book chat. Okay, so Erica, did you read some poetry for National Poetry Month?
I am still in the process of reading poetry for National Poetry Month.
Excellent.
I'm reading two selections and then a novel in verse currently.
Ooh.
So I'm reading Tuff Taylor's Work and Days, and it's kind of about farming, small-scale farming, and it goes by season. I've actually finished that one.
Is that the one that Sarah Lawson mentioned in our last episode before Festival of the Book?
Yes, and I picked it up because it didn't have any holds on it.
Mm-hmm. I think there might be one now because I think I put it on hold as soon as she mentioned it.
Was she at Festival, though? That's what I can't recall.
She, I don't know if she's one of the authors who had to cancel due to weather, but she was definitely on the schedule.
Okay, that's what I thought. Yeah, so I read that, and I'm reading Rupi Kaur's second book, The Sun and Her Flowers. And people might be familiar with Rupi Kaur's first book, Milk and Honey, which I just learned via YouTube video. She actually self-published and it went wildly viral and super successful. And this is her first, I think, collection through a publisher, like officially.
Cool.
Yeah, and that is about a large variety of things. I'm only about halfway through, and so far it continues her themes of like self-acceptance, and it also kind of covers overcoming assault, mm-hmm. and a little bit of the refugee experience.
So yeah, similar themes to the other one.
Yeah, it's very good. I have to take it in short bursts, though.
Right, it's very heavy content.
And also, like, some of these, this is so dumb, and this is how I prefer to read poetry sometimes, when I'm, like, really slogging through books, and I'm like, this is supposed to be short and easy. It's not supposed to be heavy, so, like, when her poems are a little bit longer, I'm like,
Yeah.
I don't want to do the long ones right now.
That makes sense.
And the third one I'm reading is called Bull. It's a YA novel by David Elliott, but it's a novel in verse, and it's a retelling of the story of the Minotaur.
Cool.
Which doesn't exactly have anything to do with me reading so much Percy Jackson lately, but isn't unrelated.
Yeah, the mythology theme is there.
I found it when I was looking for novels in verse in the catalog for social media for April for poem sections. And I was like, well, that's interesting. And I don't actually know all of my Greek myths, so I could learn more. I don't like the way it's told, but it's told in a way that I think would really grab teens. Like, it's got cursing, and it's really, not sexually explicit, but, like, kind of, awesome's not the word I want. What's the word I want? Because it's not describing what happens, it's talking about it in, like, a jocular way.
Yeah.
Isn't there a word for that?
How am I supposed to know? What am I, a dictionary?
Oh, words are so hard. Anyway, I think it would really appeal to teens. I think it brings it to their level. The poems each have their own personality because he's kind of doing it by character. So like Poseidon will get a chance to talk, and then it'll switch to Minos or Minos.
That's cool.
And then it'll switch to Astron, Assyrian, whatever.
So a good option for readers who like stuff that are things that are based on the mythology.
Yeah, especially if they've tried to read something like the Iliad or the Odyssey and just been like, I don't know what's happening in this hurt. You know what I mean? Like, it's not heavy. It's designed to be light and kind of humorous.
And it's got, like, accessible language in a way that the Odyssey and Iliad might not.
Yeah, definitely.
That's cool.
I'm not a sexual fan because I think it is aimed at me.
Right.
Body. Body is the word I want. Because I'm just like, I mean, like, this is funny if you're a 14-year-old boy. But
right.
Like, I'm just like, Excellent. All right. So, are you reading poetry?
I am. And you know that's not my favorite thing to read. I read two collections so far in this month for poetry. I read Reconnaissance by Carl Phillips.
Oh, I saw that on Goodreads today. Is it good? I'm looking forward to it.
It's... So I am one of those poetry readers who, if you don't tell me exactly what it is that you're talking about, I will never know what you're talking about.
Mm.
And that's sort of how this book was for me. So I can understand if you're somebody who enjoys lyrical poetry and just wants the experience and, like, the pleasure of reading something well-crafted and that flows, and then you would really love this. But for me, I was just like, all of these metaphors and similes, I have no idea what we're actually talking about. I'm always looking for, like, the narrative in a story or in what I'm reading, and I just couldn't find it in this.
Well, then you might like Bull by David Elliott.
No, exactly. So that's why when I'm looking for things that are poetic, I'm usually looking more for novels and verse than poetry.
Yeah, and you have quite a few now, which is excellent.
Yes, it's a more and more popular format. But the other collection I read, I enjoyed a little bit more. And so that is, or it was, In Full Velvet by Jenny Johnson. And so that was very, like, introspective and felt autobiographical, and she's touching on ideas of, like, love and gender through her experience as a queer woman, and there's less of that kind of ornamental language, less simile and metaphor, so it was easier for me to kind of dig in and be like, oh, I do understand what you're trying to tell me.
Yeah, it's pretty straightforward.
But what's neat about her is that she went to school at UVA, and she spent several summers teaching in the Young Writers Workshop. So some of it has a little bit of local flavor. Some of the poems mention places in Richmond, like Belle Isle. She talks about going to the James River. And then there's one poem in here that's called Ladies Arm Wrestling Match at the Blue Moon Diner. Which is pretty explicitly about Claw at the Blue Moon Diner. So it's pretty cool. That was a neat thing to find in here. But
absolutely. No, like, please remind me to read these after I do my next reading.
Yeah, and the nice thing is, you know, these are those really small collections of poetry where if you want to sit down and read it all at once, you're going to be done in, like, 30 minutes, unless you like to pore over each poem, which then you might take a little longer, but... So that's nice, too.
That's exciting. I'm looking forward to reading both of those.
Yeah. I think that you will probably enjoy them more than I did, because I know that you have more of a... You are more open to more kinds of poets than I am. But...
You like poetry, yeah.
Yeah. So thanks for joining me for book chat from afar. We had trouble getting into the same room at the same time over the past few weeks, so... Apologies for the poor recording quality. Now we're going to hear from Gail about the upcoming renovations at the Gordon Avenue Branch Library.
So today we are talking with the branch manager for the Gordon Avenue Library, Gail. Thanks for being with us.
Oh, thanks for having me.
And we're talking about the renovations coming up in just a few short weeks. Can you tell me a little bit more about what will be happening during the renovations?
Okay, it's just 3 weeks away, so the time is really flying by. Well, there are actually going to be two projects going on at once during this renovation project. The bathrooms will be renovated to make them ADA compliant. They'll have new tile, new fixtures, a complete overhaul of the restrooms. But the really exciting part of the project is that the children's room will have a new design element to brighten the room. There'll be a woodlands theme, and so we're going to have trees. The one existing pillar will become a tree, and then we'll have two trees over by the bay window. There's going to be new lighting, and the ceiling will be replaced with large leaves, big green leaves up in the ceiling. There'll be new carpeting that's going to have a blue stream or creek running through it. And the story time steps over by the windows will be blue, and it will actually look like a waterfall.
Aww.
And then there'll be a vine sort of archway leading into the children's room to get you ready for that theme of the woods and the forest.
Oh, that's nice.
And then we'll also hopefully have some new child-friendly furniture. So the overall layout of the room will be the same. So the bookshelves will be exactly the same. So that part will be familiar, but the overall look will be bright and enticing.
No, it sounds really nice. Did the staff have anything to do with the design?
We did. We got to give a lot of input, and actually the design for the room was done by Virginia A&E of Forest, Virginia. No pun intended there. But yes, we met with them several times, and we talked about wanting a woodlands design because Gordon Avenue is nestled amongst trees here in the neighborhood, so we thought that would be leading the indoors to the outdoors.
Yeah, that's such a good theme for a children's room. So when does this begin, and how long do you think it's going to last?
Well, we will actually be closed beginning on Tuesday, April the 10th until late May. I think the actual completion date is May 27th, but we hope that things will go well and maybe we can open before that. There will be 2 days for moving the children's collection and all the furniture out of the room, and then the actual construction will begin on Thursday, April the 12th.
And you guys are going to reopen a little bit for holds and checkouts.
Right. On Friday, April the 13th, we'll open a room downstairs in the library so patrons can come pick up holds and also bring in the return items. And you just come in through the double white doors off the parking lot, and staff will be to the right in the north room. And if you're familiar with the book sale, you'll know that the north room is the room where children's books are during the sale. And it's also normally our small meeting room. So we'll be there for a few hours each day. Monday through Fridays, we'll be open from 10 to 12 and then 3 to 6 in the afternoon. And on Saturdays, we'll be open from 10 to 12 for people to pick up holds and bring us the returns. But, you know, unfortunately, we're not going to have access to any of our collection.
Yeah.
So there won't be anything for people to check out or browse. And we'll also be able to return books to us, and we're going to move a book drop down to the back door. The drive-through book drop on Ackley Lane will be closed. There'll be a lot of construction vehicles there. So that will be closed during the entire renovation, but we will take returns downstairs.
Great. So, when was the last time Gordon got renovations, like full-on renovations like this?
I don't know. There's been full-on renovations. Gordon Avenue, of course, was built in 1966 and opened then. So, like any older building, it's had to have projects along.
Upkeep.
All the time, right. And we were trying to figure this out today. You know, what were the dates of all these events? And we couldn't remember everything. There was an elevator installed in around 2012, and that was a massive project.
I bet.
And then since I've been here, there was an HVAC system replacement about 4 years ago. And then about 2 years ago, there was a new lighting and ceiling done in the adult collection.
But nothing really cosmetic. No,
this is going to be the largest project, I think, in a very long time. And that's why the library has to be closed, because it is such a large project.
Yeah, it makes sense. Is there anything else we should talk about renovations-wise or logistics?
Yeah, I do want to mention that the Friends of the Library will remain open during the renovation. They operate down in the basement of the library as well, so they will be here Monday through Saturday from 9 until 4:30. And then after the sale, they'll be accepting book donations beginning again on a Saturday, April 14th.
So this was kind of structured to start after the sale.
Right, after the sale. We didn't want to do anything that would interfere with the Friends having their wonderful book sale.
I know. They do such good work for us. Okay, so if that's everything about the renovation.
I think so. It's just we're excited about it.
Oh, yeah.
We're apprehensive. There's a lot of planning and things that have to happen. But everybody's been working really hard to make it come to pass.
So is the staff going to stay in this building, or are they going to move around a little bit?
Everything's going to happen with the staff. Some of the staff will be here to help the patrons for picking up holds. Then some of the staff are going to take long overdue vacations. And then staff will be working in other branches. So they'll get some wonderful experiences working elsewhere.
No,
some at Northside and Crozet and, you know, just all around.
Yeah. No, that's great. I was curious about that.
Mm-hmm.
Okay, so to depart entirely from our renovations talk, we ask everybody who joins us what they're reading. So can you tell me, have you read anything recently that you want to talk about?
Well, I just finished Still Me by JoJo Moyes, and I don't think that needs a whole lot of introduction for most people who remember Me Before You, and what was the second one?
Is this the third one?
This is the third one. And I think it was good. I enjoyed it. I think it's a little more upbeat than maybe the others, so I think she's heading and growing in the right direction. I enjoyed it.
That's good. I haven't actually read those yet.
You haven't?
I've had them recommended to me, but I haven't gotten around to it.
And then I'm currently reading one of my guilty pleasures about the British royal family. I tend to be an authority.
We have so many good books on
it. I know. Well, this is a new one by Andrew Morton, and it's called Wallace in Love. It's about Wallace Simpson. Yeah, quite a gal.
Yeah.
And then I always have a nonfiction book going as a book on tape in the car. And I've just finished up Sargent's Women by Donna Lacey. Actually, Donna Lucy, excuse me. It was a fascinating book. I really enjoyed that.
And what was it about?
It was about some of the women that John Singer Sargent painted.
Oh, okay.
And these incredible women of the Gilded Age. It's a fascinating book.
Now, is The Wallace in Love also nonfiction?
Yes.
Oh, okay.
Yeah, I read a lot of nonfiction.
So. I do, too.
Yeah.
Sometimes I find myself not quite reading as much fiction as I think I should.
Well, I think I go in spurts.
Yeah, definitely bounce back and forth. Is that everything?
I think so.
Anything else you feel like we should mention?
I don't think so. Just, you know, we're excited about the renovation and really can't wait to invite people back into this wonderful space. And to have it finished just before summer reading,
I think it's
going to be so exciting.
Yeah.
And so everyone should mark their calendar for Wednesday, June 13th for Gordon Avenue's Ice Cream Social, which is the big kickoff for our summer reading program.
Yeah.
And also to get a new look at the children's room.
All right. Well, thank you for joining us today.
Thank you for having me.
Okay, some good information from Gail. We're glad that we had the chance to chat with her before Gordon closes for a little while. Okay, and now we're going to move on to the talk that Dr. Addison Hobbs gave at the Northside Library in February.
Good evening.
Good evening.
My name is Evan Stankovics, Adult Services Librarian at the Northside Library, and I want to thank you all for joining us tonight for a very special program. We'll start with a discussion with guest speaker, Dr. Addison Hobbs. We are honored to have with us this evening a local resident and semi-professional baseball player whose experiences in many ways mirror those of the subject of this evening's film. Dr. Addison Hobbs was born in Prince George's County, Maryland, and attended Hampton University at 16 years old, where he received his bachelor's in trade education. Until 1957, he played semi-professional baseball for a number of all-African American teams and amassed a reputation as a first-rate pitcher. Succeeding baseball, Dr. Hobbs obtained his PhD from Rutgers University and pursued a career in education, routinely defying prejudice along the way and ultimately achieving the esteemed position of president of the National Education Group of Vocational Educators. Dr. Hobbs retired in 1989 as the Assistant State Superintendent of Trade and Industrial Education for the state of Maryland. Ladies and gentlemen, please help me to welcome Dr. Addison Hobbs.
Thank you for joining us this evening, Dr. Hobbs. Putting baseball aside for the moment, could you tell us about your childhood, your professional career, and your work in the field of education?
That's a big story, you know. I've been around a while, so if I go by the number of years that I have lived compared to my experiences, we'll be here a while.
Can you highlight some things?
I played baseball, I suppose, from the time that I knew it was a baseball. We played with little balls that were so poor that when you struck them, they would mash. And what started out as something round ended up as something else. However, for some reason, my aunt, who was taking care of me, one day took me by the hand and said, Addison, you're going to school. I said, what? You're going to school? I said, I'm not old enough. She said, yes, you are. She took me by the hand and took me to the school, which was only a couple of blocks away, and told them that I was 5 going on 6, when I was really 4 going on 5. That followed me throughout my career. It seemed like I was always 2 years behind. I finished elementary school in Maryland and went to junior high school in the District of Columbia. After finishing high school there, I wanted to join the Navy, and my dad said no. I was only 16 years old and I had to have his signature, so I didn't get to go to the Navy. I'm not sure that I missed anything. From that, I went to Hampton and I grew from a scrawny little kid to just a skinny kid. And I went out for the football team and the coach told me to bring the water bucket. You're too good. So I tried basketball and too small for that too. I was trying to be the man bringing the ball down the court and it kept taking it away from me. But after 3 tries, I finally made the basketball team. But the one thing that I thought that I was pretty good in my performance was baseball. And the reason why I thought that is because I lived near a river. And I used to go there and put bottles on one side of the river and then walk over to the other side and throw curb stones at the bottles. And I built up arm strength. So by the time that I was in 12th grade, one day I told my seating buddy, I said, you know, I was at the game the other day, I can do that. He said, well, have you ever played on a team? And I said, no, but I can throw the ball. He looked at me and he said, don't fool with me now. I'm going to take up for you. And he went to the coach and said, coach, you need a pitcher? The coach says, you always need a good pitcher. He said, well, my buddy here is your man. And so coach got his glove and I worked out for a half an hour, 40 minutes, and before you know it, I had a uniform. I was a pitcher for my high school team. Well, by that time, I was 16 years old and ready to go to college. That's when I wanted to be the sailor, and my dad said, no. he asked my brother, he said, what is he good for? And my brother said, well, he has an A in graphics. And Dad said, graphics? He said, yeah, printing. He said, oh, he can get a good job doing that. Now find out where they have printing. My brother came back a few days later and said, they have printing at Tuskegee and Hampton. And my dad said, oh, I have an aunt in Norfolk. He can go over and get a meal every now and then. Let's send him to Hampton. And so that was the beginning of my upper echelon study. I came to Hampton. I didn't like it. But I knew very well that my choices were slim. And then I met another fellow who just constantly told me that, Hobbs, you can do a lot of things if you just try. And I tried out for the boxing team. And after one round, I mean, I decided boxing was not for me. And the fellow was only about 120 pounds. It looked like he hit me 50 times. So I decided I wasn't going to be a boxer. And I went out for club basketball. And I did that for a year. And I did it pretty well. And the next year, I made varsity basketball. But I still was not playing my best game, which was baseball. But they dropped baseball during the war, and I never did get to play baseball at Hampton. However, one day I was playing football on the church ground, and coach saw me, and he said, where are you from? I said, D.C. He said, where'd you play ball? I said, I didn't. I was too small. He said, well, how much do you weigh now? I said, maybe 150, 160. He said, are you tough? And I said, yeah, I think so. He said, well, come down to the gym this afternoon. I went down to the gym, and he had a uniform for me. And I punted a couple of times, and I had been just fooling around. I could kick the ball 40, 50 yards. He said, He said, well, how would you like to play varsity football? And I said, well, coach in high school told me I was too small. He said, we can fix that. We'll give you a big uniform. And so I went out for split end, and I could catch passes, and that's what I wanted to do. But one day he came in and showed a movie, and in the movie it showed this person taking the ball from a crouch position from a fellow who was a center. And he said, I want you to go over there and try that. And I went over and I took the ball, and he said, now I want you to throw it down the feel as far as you can. And I must have thrown it 40 or 50 yards down the field. And then it came back, he said, you're not a split end, you're a quarterback. Well, the regular first string quarterback was hurt. And the next thing you know, September came, and guess who was first string quarterback? It was me. And I played 4 years at Hampton. And my thinking of the best thing that ever happened was when Hampton won the championship in 1947, and we went to Miami Beach to play in the classic there. And of course, I was behind the center, but they had a smart coach. And their coach said, I want you to flag old Hobbs and scout him. I don't care whether he has the ball or not. Tackle him. And he was talking to someone about 260 pounds and 6'5" tall. And we got into the game, and Florida A&M was the team we were playing. And they scored. It was 6-0. And our time came. Coach said, Hobson, I think you can do something. Go out there. I went out there, and every time I looked, this 265-pound man was grabbing me and throwing me down on the ground. It hurt. And I said to myself, what can I do? I can't outrun him. He's running faster than I am. He's hurting me. And I don't know. We had a halfback who was kind of scary. And the plays we were supposed to use was I was supposed to take the ball, spin around, and hand it off to him. Well, one time he decided he wasn't going to take it. And I looked down and I said, oh, but the hell, oh, what do I do now? And he started talking to me, and we were both running toward the sidelines. And he said to me, your mama's not going to know you when you get home. And I said, don't hurt me, don't hurt me. He laughed. And when he laughed, I cut back, ran 35 yards for a touchdown. On the way back home to Hampton, we had to stop in Jacksonville. They stopped in Jacksonville. They went over to Florida A&M. And the whole trip from Miami to Jacksonville, he was looking for number 14. He was talking to number 14, but I said, I don't know where he is. Well, after that, I decided school wasn't too bad. And I began teaching. And I learned very quickly how to get along with people, particularly little people, or young people, I should say. And I taught middle school for, oh, maybe 16 years, and enjoyed every bit of it, because we were working with special ed kids, and they were very appreciative. One of the good things about that was I met one of those kids, and it was one that my wife had helped. And he said, oh, Dr. Hobbs, Mrs. Hobbs, it's so good to see you. And I said, Andrew, what are you doing? He said, oh, I'm doing a few things. I said, well, the last time I saw you, you were having difficulty getting a job. He said, well, I listened to you and Mrs. Hobbs, and I learned to drive. So I drove a taxi, and then I bought a taxi. And then I took that money and I used it to buy an apartment. I said, well, you did pretty good. He said, well, I went even further. The young lady you asked me, did I know I married her? And she's been very helpful to me. But I just wanted you to know, if you and Mrs. Hobbs ever need a job, you can get one with me. That was probably the best thing that I ever heard in my teaching career. I went on with a master's degree at NYU, and I went to NYU because NYU was giving courses in Washington, D.C., because at that time, the masters were only given at the white schools, and they weren't letting blacks into white colleges at that time. And so rather than to just say you can't come to the University of Maryland, even though you're a citizen, we'll just say that you don't have the skills necessary. And don't you think that while I was Assistant State Superintendent of Schools of Maryland, that I didn't remind them that how come I wasn't smart enough to be a student here, but I'm a professor here now? Well, you shouldn't do that. I know you don't do mean for mean. But things did work out. I decided that my teaching was best in my field that I had chosen, which was printing. And so I got a technical master's degree at NYU. And I went there 3 summers, and my wife was so helpful. I would get on the phone and dictate a paper to her. She would type it up, run to the main post office in D.C., and mail it so I'd have it at 8:30 the next morning to turn in. And she did that the whole 2.5 years that I went to. Just wonderful. what I am, if I am anything positive, came because I had good people, family, and particularly my wife. She was a champion and could do any and everything. She was not only a special ed person, but she also was a policewoman in D.C. And she never really fussed at me. She would let me know that if I were not doing something that she considered the way I should. But she had a little habit of taking that certificate for a professional pistol shooter and put it on my pillow. And even the kids would look and say, "Dad, you're in trouble." Well, I went on to get the doctorate degree, and again, she stepped through. I made a speech out in South Dakota, and I was telling people about the fact that there were no blacks in high positions in vocational education, and yet we were doing a lot of those jobs, particularly in carpentry and automotive. And what do you need? They said, well, you give them a stipend and you give them tuition remission. And I said, yeah. I said, well, that's what you do. Well, after I didn't ram my mouth, that night two people came to my room. One was the dean at Rutgers and the other was the dean at Ohio State, and said, you know, we feel like you have a point and we'll give the $10,000 in tuition remission to whomever you recommend. And I said, okay. So I came home and time went by and I couldn't get anybody to say yes that I knew, and I was fussing to Dorothy and I said, you know, I can't get anybody to take that scholarship that I was able to work on. And I said, it's a shame, it's a good opportunity for somebody. Dorothy just looked at me and said, why don't you do it? I said, sweetheart, we got four children and three of you are in school. You know, how are things gonna get done if I go off to school? She said, well, you said Rutgers, it's in Ohio, New Brunswick, that's not that far, you could come home on weekends. Anyway, she talked me into it, and I went to Rutgers, and I got my doctorate degree, and I utilized it for a number of things, and I was very successful with it. However, that did not do anything with my baseball. Didn't really have time for it anymore. Things changed, as you know. Jackie came along, and other things changed. And it just did not make sense for me to give up a good job that had fairly good pay to start all over again in a D league or a C league or even AAA weren't paying that much. So, and I had the kids. So I forgot about baseball and I went into education, and that's what I did until I retired.
You brought a book with you. Did you want to read an excerpt from the book?
What's the book?
Yeah, did you want to share the title?
This says, A Complete History of the Negro Leagues by Mark Brzozowski. And the first chapter says, just another ball player. The challenge for blacks is to learn something about the game in order that we will know what's going on out on the ball field and won't humiliate Jackie by our lack of knowledge. This was an article in the Pittsburgh Courier on April 19th, 1947. On April 15th, 1947, when baseball heaven and earth parted for Jackie Robinson to take the field as a Brooklyn Dodger, the arrival of the first African-American player in modern major history, maybe have unleashed a metaphoric fire and rain, but the mood at Ebbets Field on that afternoon was somewhat less ecstatic. On this historic occasion, which had been otherwise intended as the Dodgers' opening day contest against the Boston Braves, no more than 26,000 fans were scattered over two-thirds of the cramped ballpark in Bedford, Brooklyn. And while an estimated 14,000 of these people were black fans that had never been out before and see a Dodger game, they greeted Robinson grandly, and it was very kind. But Branch Rickey, the one, as you know, who picked up on Robbie, he was a slick dude. he kind of held a side thing, and without telling blacks how to act, he kind of conducted a little game, and he said that he's going to admonish the black community against getting too carried away just because Jackie went out there. He said that 2 months before, at a black tie dinner held by black civic leaders in New York, Rickey implored them not to make Robinson into a political cause celebrated person, not to stage parades and welcoming committees, or to hold Jackie Robinson days. He told him, if you do that, you're going to mess this whole thing up. So we're going to play cool. We're not going to come there drunk. We're not going to do loud talking and cussing. We're not going to do fussing. But we're going to sit back, enjoy the game, and act very civilized. And that's what happened on that first day because of what Branch Rickey did, aside from the fact of giving Jackie an opportunity. He also worked with the community. And in working with the community, it enabled Jackie to kind of loosen up, because he had to be nervous. I did not ever meet Jackie face to face. I simply saw people who knew him, but I never met him. The only person that I met that was in the, I call it uppity group, was my man Satchel Paige. And he was time enough for whites and blacks. Now, I was able to meet Jack Satchel in 1943. I was going into Griffith Stadium because Armstrong High School, my high school, had won the high school championship baseball. And I was coming in, and Satchel was going out. And of course, I said, oh, hi, Mr. Paige. Will you do something for me? And he said, what do you want me to do? I said, show me how to throw your knuckle curve. And he did. He showed me how to put that curve up there. And he said, now you can throw it three ways. You can throw it overhand, you can throw it round arm, or you can throw it underhand. And each one will give you a different break. And so that ended my baseball career at that point. But I did play a few games when I was at Hampton during the summers that I was there doing my internship. Bonnie, who had a bar there, would put together teams on weekends, and we would play all over Virginia, just playing ball. And he would give us a meal and $25. And being a college student, working for 13 cents an hour, that was very helpful in terms of what I could do. I also played ball in Louisiana. And I guess that's where I played most of my ball. I had an agent, who owned the store, and he had a telephone, and people who needed a picture would call, and he would take down and bring to me, and we would set up a schedule. And I played there. Much of my playing had to be there in Louisiana, and played Texas, and we would catch all the guys coming from Canada and here going down to Mexico and Texas and other warm places during the winter. Cuba, got to go to Cuba once. Sat there and couldn't order from the menu, and I ate one meal the whole 3 days we were there. But I remember I didn't speak Spanish. No habla español. Speak better now than I did then. But we played there once, and I didn't win that day. Those guys were pretty good. First time I'd ever seen a ball hit from me, off me, that was not only hit in the stadium, this one was knocked outside the stadium, out the ballpark, it really was. And so then I knew that I wasn't a hot shot that I thought I was. That there was more to that baseball thing than I could imagine. That was the only experience I had with baseball at that level. Met a lot of folks, wonderful folks, who you'd be surprised did not implore me to continue playing baseball. It was felt by many of my colleagues that I had a college degree and that's what I ought to be doing. And I was keeping a ball player from earning a living by trying to play baseball when I had a degree. I didn't agree with them until that ball went sailing and I realized that it wasn't going to be as easy as I thought. I'll stop right here and get back to the agenda.
Well, I was just going to ask if you could share, you had a nickname among your teammates. Could you share that with everybody?
We had a catcher who was quite a dude, and he gave everybody a nickname, and so my nickname was Baby Boy. One time we were playing the Indianapolis Clowns, and they, off right to the end, did a lot of clowning stuff. And he said, just a minute. And he went over to the bench and asked the ball boy to bring him something. And I thought maybe he was getting some balls. He got a rocking chair. And then he sat back there and he rocked, hey baby boy, bring it to me baby, and he was back there singing while I was zooming that ball in there. He had a sponge in his glove, and of course when the ball struck it, it just made a big old sound, you know. But that was my nickname, Baby Boy.
You told me a very moving story when we met a week ago about an incident in Montgomery, Alabama.
Oh, yeah.
At a train station. Did you mind sharing that?
I went over to Jacksonville. My wife was having a baby, and I went to Jacksonville to help. But I got over there, and the baby was slow coming, and I ran out of money. So I had to get back to Louisiana to make some money to take care of my family. And I caught a train that left Jacksonville and went through Montgomery to New Orleans. And I didn't have any money, but I didn't need any because somebody was going to meet me in New Orleans, which was close to Winfield, where I lived. And I didn't need any money, I thought. Anyway, I got there and the train had left. And there I was with no money, training school, and don't know anybody. So I took my little pasteboard suitcase and I was walking back and forth, and I realized that they had closed the two rooms, one white and one colored. But they left the white one open so that they could stay there and wait for the next train the next morning at 8 o'clock. But they closed the colored one. And so I had nowhere to go. And I walked on the bench outside. I was tired, and the policeman came by and told me I was loitering and that I couldn't stay there. And so now here I am with my little heavy suitcase. I have no money. The policeman wants to lock me up for loitering. I don't know anybody. And you talk about really understanding religion and learning to pray. I did. And lo and behold, a black guy came by, stopped, said, "Look like you're in trouble." I said, "I am," and I told him what happened. And he said, "Well, you're in luck." And I said, "What do you mean?" He said, "Well, my wife isn't home, but I'll take you home with me and sleep you, get up and fix you breakfast, and then bring you back here to catch your train in the morning." He said, "Now I know what you're thinking. Why is this guy doing that? I don't know him." He said, "But I'll do that for you." "Well, what can I do?" I said, "Okay." He did exactly what he said he was going to do. When I got back to Winfield, Louisiana, I made sure that I was going to write this gentleman and thank him, but I was also going to send him a check. I wrote the check and I sent it. The check came back, no such address. So I know my guardian angel had taken care of me, because I know I wrote that address down. So I have had not only a family that's been behind me, but I've had the Holy Ghost behind me too in my 90 years of living on this earth.
Thank you, Dr. Hobbs. I think we've got a few minutes left. We could probably take one or two questions. Anybody have any questions for Dr. Hobbs?
If you can, express it. What did Jackie Robinson mean to you personally, seeing him rise to the heights that he did?
Having a cousin and a nephew that were in the ball business, knowing their life, I didn't think that that was the thing for me. I leaned heavily on my parents, who wanted me to do something other than play ball. And I was glad that I listened to them. But I was happy for Jackie, because I met a lot of those guys the short time that I was on the road, and they were good people. And I thought that they should be treated differently than treated as second-class citizens. Also, I thought that the general public should understand better what they were going through. I could not understand why the white boys would go to a restaurant and sit down at a table and eat, and we had to go to the kitchen and eat out in the backyard or eat on the table on the backyard. How they got rooms at motels and hotels, and what we had to do was to find somebody who would shack us up for that particular night until the game the next day. So Jackie making it meant that they had to give him some of those things that I thought I missed. And so I was very selfish about how they treated him, and that he would get the kind of treatment that he deserved as a human being.
Thank you so much, Dr. Hobbs.
What a wonderful talk. I'm so glad that Dr. Hobbs agreed to come in and speak at the Northside Library and I'm even more thrilled that we were able to record it and he allowed us to include it in this episode. It's really wonderful to be able to hear from somebody directly about their experiences. And I could tell everyone in the room was really just thrilled to be there. The energy was really great. So thank you for tuning in. We hope that you enjoyed this. We'll be back in 2 weeks with a recording from another event that we're very excited about. But in the meantime, be sure to subscribe wherever it is that you listen to this and other podcasts. And if you can, rate or review. That helps other people find us. As always, a big thank you to the Friends of the Library, whose generous support makes this podcast, as well as events like Dr. Hobbs' talk at the Northside Library, possible. If you have a chance, stop by the Friends of the Library book sale. It's going on right now. And the hours and dates will be listed in our show notes. So thanks once again for tuning in, and we're glad to be on the same page.